Okay, good evening. It's Tuesday night, August 28th. Welcome to Rabbi Feldman's weekly shiur. This week's shiur is sponsored by an anonymous donor in honor of Rabbi Feldman.
Thank you, Mr. Anonymous. Okay, speaking of anonymous donors, we were finishing off the topic of tzedakah, which I think where we left off, I didn't think the words that we left off with last time, if I'm not mistaken, is we had been talking about the fact that on the surface there appears to be a prohibition, or maybe two prohibitions, to decline tzedakah, and we talked about how do you get out of that prohibition, and how are we not in trouble by the fact that most of us are in settings where we're approached on a several times a day basis for tzedakah, and it's hard to imagine that we respond to every request. Even the most generous of us aren't able to do that. So how do we avoid violating two prohibitions every time we say no? So I think we talked about a little bit about how, first of all, the boundaries of de maestro, of what exactly is the responsibility towards a needy individual, and when is that limited, when is that expanded. And the suggestion that the prohibitions go hand in hand with this concept of Zenachzer, and we talked a little bit of the implications of that. And we also mentioned the fact that some Rishonim suggest that we look at the Pasuk literally, and the Pasuk says, don't harden your heart, don't close your fist or harden your heart, that that's a connected theme. That it's not simply saying no that is problematic, but it's that saying no that comes from a hardness of the heart. That if you say, I don't believe I have to give any tzedakah, you think it, your attitude is that every man for himself, I made this money, it's all for me, and you're not interested in giving any tzedakah, so then you're at risk of a prohibition. But if you have a good reason for saying no, so then it might be a different story, and the good reasons, as we started to explain, could include that maybe the person asking is a suspect, maybe not reliable. Here you have some qualms about how reliable they are. We mentioned the statement in the Talmud that we should, it's a somewhat cynical statement, that we should be grateful to the liars. We should express our appreciation to those who are dishonest, because whatever percentage of the population that is mixed into the group makes us justified in suspecting everybody, unfortunately. Again, it sounds like a somewhat cynical attitude, but that's what gets us off the hook, the fact that we're not sure who's telling the truth because of the population of people who aren't telling the truth. So that is one aspect, but there's also other legitimate reasons to say no, such as you've hit your limit. We have a limit somewhere in between 10% and 20% that we spoke about previously, a recommendation of at least 10% with a maximum of 20%. That could again be a legitimate reason to say no, hit your limit. And the topic that we're changing to now, that maybe you have money and you want to give tzedakah, but you have other priorities, and you know those other priorities are on the table, and if I give to this guy who asks, I'm not going to have it for my next priority. So how exactly do we prioritize within stock? How exactly do we decide? Once we've talked about already the question of diversifying versus concentrating, and we talked about this aspect of de maestro. Now once we've established those parameters, so how do you decide who comes first? Hi?
I have a question. Now, the effect of this self-organization.
List of people.
Reach the point
and
get
self-dependent
on everything.
Right.
What are you supposed to do?
Change your mailbox.
No, seriously.
Right. So I think we touched upon that a little bit. The letters presumably don't put you at obligations of velo sikbo, velo samme. So these prohibitions are probably not relevant under those circumstances. Because again, first of all, as far as Dei Maestro is concerned, this is not somebody from your community. This is not somebody who's your neighbor who's needy. This is somebody who's literally writing to hundreds or thousands of people. So that already is something you're allowed to factor in, and you have to see that as your responsibility. Then there is the question of, okay, so they're not, I don't have to provide them with all their needs, but how does it fit into the pantheon? So first of all, there is the question of, again, you still have a limit to how much stock you can give, no matter how many letters you get. And you're not going to say, well, I'll divide up among the letters, but I give 50 cents to each one, and nobody gets anything, and the postage costs more than the... Well, it costs more than the... I feel bad, you know, without without naming them on tape, you know, I'm talking about whether there's a certain organization that gives out tzarim, and the idea is we'll give tzedakah for whatever the least he had to pay for. And I just feel bad because it wouldn't necessarily be my first choice. I'm not going to give them a lot of money. But if I give them a little bit of money, I don't want to take the safer because the safer costs more than I'm giving them. So then I'm not helping anybody. So then they're going to end up still at a deficit because I'm giving them. So then it makes my stock a total waste. So if you're going to diversify so much just so you give everybody something, so then their postage costs more than that. It's not really helping anybody. So that's also a legitimate factor. But then there's the question that you still have the right and the responsibility, rather, I should be instead of the responsibility to prioritize. Okay, so I got 7 letters today, and I got 49 letters this week, right? So it means, you know, whatever it is, 2,500 letters a year. So I have to catch it out. So what are the most important causes? What fits my attitudes and my few of them? And as we started at the beginning, there is a certain amount of discretion here. You have a right to have a pet cause. You know, you have a right to have structures that simply appeal to you because they make sense. And there is a certain amount of discretion involved. And we're going to talk a little bit about what types of factors go into this discretion. So, first of all, first and foremost, the biggest priority that you have is family, somebody who is related to you. So that takes the highest priority. And here is one of the factors where, as I mentioned last time, there are differences sometimes when we're talking about your own money versus talking about some public fund. If you're an administrator of a public fund, maybe you're a rabbi with a rabbinic discretion fund, or maybe you're a gabbai tzedakah of some sort, that you're in charge of some type of organization. So then the rules can be different. Sometimes they're completely different. Sometimes they're opposite. So this is one of the areas in which they're opposite. That if it's a question of relatives, so as someone giving his own money, the responsibility is primarily towards the relatives. Now, if you're giving out public money, you're not allowed to prefer your relatives. You have to remove that from the equation. So here's really one of the many details, as we'll see, where things go in opposite directions. In private money, you should worry about your relatives first. Then there is some discussion among the poskim. There's a lengthy tshuva about this, and there's a contemporary sefer called the tshuva of Yashiv Yitzchak. There's a lengthy tshuva about the question of, there is an attitude that you find, it's based on some earlier sources, that when you're giving to your relatives, you should only give 50% to your relatives. You shouldn't give everything to the relatives, that, for whatever reason. So you have a certain amount of tzedaka, give 50% to your relatives and give the other half elsewhere. So it's some question whether or not that's a real din, whether it's a real recommendation. Some suggest that it's only true if a person, let's say, says he wants to give a certain neder to tzedakah for whatever reason. He says, I'm going to give X amount of money to tzedakah. So then in defining that neder, you should include only 50% for your relatives, and the other 50% should go for other poor people who are not related. But that if it's your stam, your maaser money, the money you have that you normally give to tzedakah, so then there's nothing wrong with giving all that to your elders. And others say, no, this is a 50% recommendation in general. So there's different attitudes towards that. There is some discussion about whether or not there is such an idea. But whether or not that part is true about the 50%, still that's the first thing we see, that the priority goes to the people you're related to. And then within relatives, it goes closest relatives first. The parents are the first closest relatives, then towards children, and then the circle of people who are closest to you. That's basically the way in which it operates. And if your public money disperses, so then this isn't something that can really make a difference to you, even though in the Tshuva Sefer Kasta Da'ani is written by Rav Sperber, so he considers for a minute the fact that maybe it may factor in. So let's say you're in charge of giving out money, so you have two equally poor people who come before you, and you happen to know that one of these two people has a rich uncle. So if you have a rich uncle, so maybe I should say, okay, so I'll give to the guy who doesn't have a rich uncle, because the guy who has a rich uncle should be getting money from him. The uncle is obligated to support his relatives. So for a minute you could think that might make a difference, but pashtus is you don't really have the ability to make a distinction based on that equation. You generally don't really know whether the uncle is living up to his responsibilities, or even if there may be some mitigating factors or what exactly is going on. So it's not really practical to factor that in. It's a thought that he has for a minute. But in general, the person who's giving out public money is not really going to be able to factor in the idea of relatives. And Moshe Feinstein points out in the Tshuva that in general, a lot of the factors that we're talking about are more relevant to people with public funds, because then you kind of have to be more objective. You kind of have to have some set of rules. Well, when you're dealing with a private individual, so your discretion can play such a role that beyond the fact that you have to give to your relatives or whatever it is, in general, you have the ability to choose how to spend your money, even when you're spending it for tzedakah purposes, so that perhaps gives you a little bit more latitude. Hi.
Yes,
it
was very interesting. But tzedakah for aniyim, or does it count to give organizations equally?
Well, when you say organizations, you mean two different things. You mean organizations for aniyim, or organizations for other things? Right. So federation is a little bit more complicated. Right. So the federation gets a little more complicated. It's really a separate discussion that we'll have at a different time, because there's so many different causes that are mixed in. But we do recognize, and we'll talk more about this a little bit later. We'll talk about it as much time we have today. We'll probably get to it today. But there are different causes other than aniyim. Right. When it comes to Maisa, there are some who maintain that Maisa should be stavka for aniyim, and there are others who feel it could be for any good cause. In general, the phrase stavka is applied more broadly. It probably could mean other good causes, most likely can mean other good causes. Again, we'll talk a little bit about how you could rank the causes. And if we talk about a discretionary fund, it could even make the case that it might mean even more than stuck. It might mean that any good cause, even if it's not defined as stuck, it's understood that people are giving the money to the rabbi to decide what he thinks is a good cause. So for example, we'll come back to this in order, but for example, let's say you're going to buy somebody's tefillin. So there's a question over whether that's called stuck or not. Because technically speaking, if somebody can't afford tefillin, right, so you're not really obligated. That's the rule, that if it costs more than a fifth of your money, so you're not obligated. So if I have somebody who's starving and somebody who needs tefillin, maybe I should make a case. I really should be giving to the guy who's starving, because that's a physical need that he's not fulfilling. He's going to be in trouble without. And the guy without tefillin, he's potter. He's exempt from tefillin. Sounds a little funny to say, but strictly speaking, he's exempt. So nonetheless, it's hard to argue that it's not a good cause. So we have different definitions for different purposes. No. This chick was beginning to borrow for Hanukkah candles, and he has to borrow for... Borrow someone's tefillin if you can. If you can. There's a little bit of a question how you borrow tefillin. Yeah, I think maybe that's a whole separate discussion. But if you can borrow tefillin, you probably should. He's not obligated to beg for the money. So... So that gets into a complicated discussion, which we'll try to discuss a little bit. There are factors that weigh things on every side. Russia Weiss has a piece about this in a Sefer that just came out on Dvarim. So in Parshas Re'eh, has a piece about this where he goes through an equation and you find that Binyan Beit HaKnesses is given a big priority, and another Achronim question that, the statement of Shulchan Aruch based on the Gemara. It's some gifts have the opposite, and where do aniyim fit in, and where do cholim fit in? So you find different rankings there, and in the end, he tries to make a list. But it's as he also points out, it's very hard to give hard and fast rules because there are so many variables, as we'll see. And he suggests, when we talk about kedima and staka, it's not the same as like to talk about kedima and brachos. If he was going to start learning brachos this year tomorrow. Then we really mean rules. I mean, 1, 2, 3. And here we talk about the rules. We're talking about preferences and we're talking about factors. But to say it in an absolute sense is a little more difficult. And we talk about things like education. So then there's additional components. That there's a takana that everybody is obligated to support the education for the town and for the children. They're part of the town. They have to be a part of that. And they're part of a shul. So that's more of a communal responsibility type of idea also. It doesn't exactly fit into the normal structure, so it gets a little complicated. We'll see how much of it we can talk about today. But as far as dealing with individuals, so you have this idea of relatives, and after relatives, so strictly speaking, here's a factor also that it's hard to really put into play practically, but you have a factor also of merit. That strictly speaking, as Shulchan Aruch says, that the biggest tzaddikim come first, and the less big tzaddikim come next, and the like. But it's very hard to really cheshbon that out. The Rav Kook had the shuva, which he says, in his man hazeh, we can't really factor that in so much. And Rav Bitzal Stern, in his shuva, Bitzal HaChachma, the brother of Debra Shini Rav, that as he observes, this is probably something also that is different when we're talking about public money versus private money. Because if it's private money, he says, you're really supposed to give your relatives first. So you can't be ranking based on tzedakahs, because then everybody will be giving just to the biggest tzaddikim, and then the people who aren't the biggest tzaddikim aren't going to get anything. So presumably this is only true for somebody who's got public money, so he's got to have some type of, so to speak, objective standard how to choose among all the different people. But people who are giving out their own money should be prioritizing really their relatives first and shouldn't be cheshbening in merit at all. If the standard exists at all, which is itself a question. There are those who suggest that maybe even if merit as a whole is not something that you can factor in, but how do you factor in the fact, let's say somebody is capable of working and isn't? Let's say somebody could be making a living, just chooses not to, and then you have somebody else who mamish has no source of income that he can do. So how do you give the same to the person that could be working? So in theory, it's a good question, but again, here in practice, you never really know what's going on with people, and it may seem like somebody is capable of working, and they may actually be not. You never know what factors are at play. So some scholars point out that there is a question, there is a serious issue for the person himself. If somebody knows that they are capable of working and they choose to take some tzedakah, so then that's a tiny against them. But as far as you're the one giving out the funds, so yeah, it's hard for you to evaluate that too strongly. And in theory, you might know. In theory, you could. Again, there's not a hard and fast absolute here, but for the most part, it's difficult for an outsider to really be able to cheshbon that in too much. So that being given, after we talk about relatives and after we talk about this whole merit system, so then we get to the most famous of the rules. The most famous of the rules that we're all familiar with is the idea of aniya yircha kodem. People who come from your town, so to speak, so that's the highest priority. And as the Meiri writes, and the Shemesh Sakhar is quoted by the Tiskei Tshuva, this is the number one rule. This is the number one policy. But even so, so there is still the assumption that the Chassam Sofer makes, and others say this as well, even though some disagree, that when we talk about a priority like an Yayirtha, really what we mean is that we're assuming that there's some type of comparable need. We're assuming that you have people who really need food, really need money, and some of them live in your neighborhood and some of them live 100 miles away. So people who live in your neighborhood are the ones who get priority. But if people who live a little bit of a distance away are starving, and the people who live closer are okay, but it's not perfect, so then you go to the people who are starving first. That's the way many posts can assume. And the Chassam Sofer really got this tradition from his Rabbi. His Rabbi was the author of Hafla. And there's a sefer in Chumash that's entitled the Panim Yafos. And the Panim Yafos, he writes in the Pasuk, in Parshas Re'eh, he writes, the Pasuk says, Ki yeh decha avyon, when there shall be a needy person among you. So the word avyon is really a more evocative word than the word ani. We use the word ani to mean a poor person, but avyon is really a more powerful term. And it comes from the language of to need, ta'ev. So this is called Ta'iv, Ta'iv Kodem, that whoever is the neediest, that comes first. That really we're prioritizing based on how big is the need. And it's only when those are equal, when everything lines up equally, then we say that, okay, we can start ranking within people. However, even that has a qualification, as the Pundit office also says, that before you have the word avion, you have the word b'cha, should be within you. So the first priority is if it's within you. So the first thing is relatives. If you're dealing with your close relatives, then you're not evaluating that they're necessarily the neediest people in the world. But if they're your relatives and they need, they come first. And then after you go beyond your relatives, then you start factoring in need as the dominant factor. So how exactly you affect that, what's a relative and what's a need, the tshuvas about this in the Stam Sofer, and tshuvas about this in the Shevet Halevi, who has a lengthy discussion based on some of the Stam Sofer's tshuvas. But what you basically see from here, the takeaway principle, is you have really these two competing principles. They don't necessarily take you in the same direction at all. You have on the one hand the principle of evaluating who's the neediest, on the other hand, who's the closest, and you're finding a balance somewhat between these two principles, which are not necessarily going the same way. Hi.
Yeah, versus
Nima, versus Rel. So okay, we'll get to that in a second. So we'll get to that in a minute. So before we get to any Eretz Yisrael, so this idea of Aniya Yerecha Kodmin, so that principle, so there is some debate as to why exactly it is. So why should we care? If you have people who are Aniyim, so what difference does it make whether they're Aniya Yerecha or not Aniya Yerecha? Like I mentioned, I was in Toronto 2 weeks ago, so somebody came up to me in the middle of Shacharis and he said, Hachnasas Kala Aniya Yerecha. Oh, you followed me all the way from New Jersey to come and ask Aniya Yerecha. So that's actually relevant to this point, because the question is, why do you prefer Aniya Yerecha? I mean, what difference does it make? So Rav Nosson Gestetner has a discussion about this in his Tshuvas, and he suggests at one point that maybe he should say this is the principle of Ein Mavir and Al HaMitzvos. Right, you don't pass up opportunities for mitzvahs in general. If you have a situation where you can do a mitzvah now, so you don't say, well, I'd rather wait till the next time. I'll pass on this one. I'll take the next time it comes around. That's what you're not supposed to do. Ain't my beer, and you don't pass. You take the first opportunity to do a mitzvah. So the problem is, if that was really the issue, so then you might come to some different conclusions. For example, there is a machlokus. The Tur quotes machlokus, the Rebar Baruch, and the Tur, about what if you have somebody who's not from your town, but he's here in your town now. He comes to your town and he's collecting. So do you prioritize him or not? So the opinion of the Rebar Baruch was that you do. But the dominant view of the Torah seems to be that you don't. You don't treat that person like Aniya Yerecha. So if the issue really was Ein Mavir Al HaMitzvah, so you don't pass up opportunities for a mitzvah, so then if they're here now, they're just as accessible. So then that should neutralize the factor of Aniya Yerecha, and the fact that it doesn't, so that indicates it's probably something else at play. And also the fact that nowadays with the electronic communications abilities that we have, if the issue was really just being able to perform the mitzvah quickly the first opportunity, so you can donate anywhere in the world in a matter of seconds. So you can claim that whole issue has been neutralized completely if that was really the whole point. So, and so the guy who came up to me in Toronto and said, Aniya Yerecha, he would have a point. I'm right there, he's right there. So the fact that I don't really live in Toronto also shouldn't make so much of a difference. So presumably the issue is something else. And this can be illustrated by a comment that Shimon Shkup has. Shimon Shkup, the great literature of Yeshiva, was well known for his shiurim on the Gemara, shiur of Shimon Shkup. He also has a sefer, an important sefer by the title, Shari Yosha. In his introduction to Shari Yosha, he has many nice ideas that are often quoted, and he makes the following point. That to the Mishnah in Perkei Avos, that we're all familiar with, Hillel says, right? If I am not for myself, then who's going to be? No one's going to be if I'm not for myself. But if I am only for myself, then money, then what am I? That's the way it's normally translated. And then we normally understand it as if it's kind of a tension between these two competing goals. On the one hand, you have to worry about yourself. On the other hand, you want to worry about everybody else. So it's life's a balance or caught somewhere in the middle. So Shimon Shkop explains very nicely that really it's not that it's two competing things, but this is all the same idea. Is that really, as human beings, you have to worry about yourself first. Otherwise, you can't live. You can't live unless you're supporting yourself, you're worrying about your needs. No one else is going to do that for you. No one else is going to worry about your basic needs. He says this in the context of explaining what Kedusha is. You know, the Medrash tells us that Kadosh Baruch Hu, Pasuk says, Kedoshim Tiyu Ki Kadosh Ani, you shall be holy like God. So the Medrash says that Yachol Kamoni, you would have thought you could be as holy as God. So the Pasuk says, no, Ki Kadosh Ani, God says, I'm the holiest, you could be almost as holy. So Shemesh Kaf explains, what does that mean? It says, to be holy means to be dedicated to others, to be worried about everybody else. So Kadosh Baruch Hu has no human needs, doesn't have any personal needs, so he can be completely Kadosh, he's all about everybody else. But the human beings have to worry about themselves at least a little bit, or else they're not going to live. So they have to worry about themselves at least a little bit, and then they can be very holy, a lot of the rest they can worry about everybody else. But they have to be worried about themselves first. So that we grant. So they may not need really, if you're not for yourself, then no one else will be for me. But says Rav Shmuel, explaining Hillel's statement, where you do have some control is, well, how do you define that word ani? So that means me, but I could define that in a broader sense. It could mean me and my family, or it could mean me and my block, or it could be me and my community, or it could be me and the whole Jewish people, or it could be me and the whole world. So my greatness, so to speak, is in how you define this word ani. You define it very narrowly as just being me, or do you define it in as broad a sense as possible, as including as broad of a circle as you possibly can? So says the Shemishkap, that's what the Mishnah is saying, in Ein Ani Limili, I have to be for myself. But Kishani Lachmi, if I translate the word Ani as meaning me personally, it just means me the individual, then Ani, it's not such a big Ani, it's not so impressive. But if I include as many people as I can, going in a straight line, so then that makes me into a bigger person. So the idea seems to always be, when it comes to chesed, that we go in this straight line going out, and you try to make the line as big as you can and include as many people. But you're not skipping lines, you're going to the closest you can. So if you go to you, to your family, to your broader family, to your neighborhood, to your community, etc., etc., and the broader you can make this line, the better, but while going in a straight line. So presumably that's what we mean when we say Ani Yeircha. And if we're talking about that, then we're really not talking about, and this seems to be the way Poskim seems to understand it, that we're really not talking about physical proximity necessarily. We're talking more about having some closeness to you, having some, being a part of your circle, however we're going to define your circle, which may not necessarily be purely geographical in definition. And the bigger a circle you can make, so then all the better. So that impacts on a couple things. So first of all, so let's say Jeff Glazer is making Aliyah, and all the people in this part of Teaneck are going to realize they can't live without Jeff Glazer. It's not, life has no taste anymore. So they all decide that we're all going to get up and make Aliyah together, and we're all gonna make a little neighborhood where you're moving to, and all of Teaneck will be there. So they'll be. There'll be maybe a minion left in Teaneck. Maybe, let's say, 10 people will still maintain a little kehillah here, but everybody will, everybody else will be over there within, say, Glazerville, we'll call it. So the question is, so now when the minion that's left in Teaneck is going to give their tzedakah, so they, should they, also they're going to send some money to Eretz Yisrael. So, should they prefer, geez, the Glazerville, right, so because they'll send the Nefesh fund to get the rest of the minion back. But assuming for whatever reason those 10 people, they're going to stay here, they'll make all the money and they'll send it all back to everybody else living in Glazerville. So these people in Teaneck, do they have any reason to give to Glazerville more than they should give to Bnei Brak? You know, or should they give to, or does it make, oh, they're not here anymore, they're not here, when they were in Teaneck, so that'd be one thing. But now they're all living in Eretz Yisrael, but there's like this Teaneck community in Eretz Yisrael. So is there any preference for that? So that was, Vahavdil ben Achaim ben Achaim was a chalukas between Reb Chaim Sanzer and Reb Chaim Blazner. The Milchus Blazner has a truth about this in the discussion, so that seems to also go to the fact that it's maybe not just a question of proximity here, both groups are in Eretz Yisrael, they're not near you anymore, but the fact that you have a shaykhus to one group was you, somebody who you were, represents your community that moved en masse, that may also be a factor to be taken into consideration. Now, what about Eretz Yisrael in general? That's the point that you make. So it says in the Shulchan Aruch, based on the Midrashim, that after Ani Yericha, so it says, well, next to Ani Yericha, it says Ani Eretz Yisrael is the priority. Now, That question, let me ask yourself, there's a couple of questions you could ask about that. So first of all, is there any preference to Yerushalayim within that? So there's some discussion about that, and the Shiva Sassan Sofer. Many suggest that there isn't the old city of Jerusalem, that it may not really have much relevance to Zmanazel, there's no Beis HaMikdash. But whatever it is, whether Yerushalayim has a special place in this equation or not, so how does any Eretz Yisrael rank against any Yerucha, which I think is the question you were raising. So that seems to be a machlokas v'poskim. And probably most poskim would seem to say on the surface that really Aniye Yerucha is the priority. First Aniye Yerucha, and then once you're leaving your town, so then Aniye Eretz Yisrael can take priority. But Aniye Yerucha probably comes first. That's the way a lot of the poskim on the side of Shulchan Aruch have it. And there are those who say differently. Those who say Aniye Eretz Yisrael is really the Aniye Eretz Yisrael is really the priority. Sorry? After relatives. Relatives are still first. But Aniye Eretz Yisrael maybe would be the priority over Aniye Eretz Yisrael. Discussing this once with Uresh Chalap, and he suggested with there's a lot to be said for the suggestion that even though the weight of the poskim is probably on the side of Aniye Eretz Yisrael over Aniye Eretz Yisrael, since that's the way Reb Bosner comes out in his Shuvos also. But one could make a good case that Bezman Hazeh things really could shift. Because, again, of the whole global village, the fact is that the way communications have developed over these past few generations, less than that over these past few years, is that people have less of a connection to the people who are closest to them geographically, because it makes less of a difference, and they're able to connect with people on the other side of the world in a second. There's not much of a delay in connecting with people, so therefore, geographical proximity, one can make a case, is really receded as a factor in a modern day context, in a global village kind of context. So if that factor is kind of limited, so then any Eretz Yisrael could become a heavier factor, and that may shift the equation somewhat. And it's basically going to boil down to, again, that the people who you have a shaykhus to somehow have a higher priority, and whether we're going to define that geographically, and it can become a variable. Hi.
See, the situation of the community where you have a lot of need, and anybody takes care of their obligations, they'll never go beyond their community.
Right. So I think it's also an important point to mention. I think I mentioned last time, I remember, that Tzilich San Sofer also assumes, and there are those who disagree with this, but this is a pretty popular assumption, that when we say we make our priorities, so we don't really mean that everything goes to priority one, and if priority one is totally filled, then you move on to priority two. And then if priority two is totally filled, then you move on to priority three, because then you're never going to get past one. Very few cases are ever going to get to number two on their list, and that's really an outgrowth of what we discussed in the first part. We're talking about the question of whether you should diversify or whether you should concentrate. So once we're saying that the majority of you seems to be like the Rambam and the Bach for different reasons that you diversify, so then presumably that goes hand in hand with this point, that when we talk about priorities, so we must mean like the Chassam Sofer saying that we don't give everything to cause one, and that only when that's totally done, they call us back and they say, thank you, we can't take any more, we're completely taken care of. Then you move on to cause two, that's not going to make any sense within this equation. So presumably what it means is that you give the bulk of your tzedakah to cause number one, and then what's left, you give the bulk of what's left to cause number two, and then what's left of that, the bulk of that to cause number three, et cetera, et cetera. You give smaller and smaller proportions to each one, but you are still leaving something over to go on to the next cause, and not to give everything to cause one. Now, post them, sorry?
Some of it means one place rather than the whole community is called.
Right, so well, here it gets a little bit subjective again as far as how you're portionalizing that, you know, but you could say that you're going to give a certain large percentage of what you have to the people in your immediate proximity, and then another smaller percentage to going a little beyond that or to different types of causes, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not that we're making a list and saying, okay, here's item one, and that gets everything. It's only when that's completely fulfilled, then you move on to clause number two. Now it's interesting also that as far as these causes are concerned, the Stipler has a discussion in one of his Svarim and the Gemara in Bava Basra, and this is a strong statement because it means we have to really define things very rigidly. It's a little bit hard to do. He says there's two types of stucca. There's stucca that you can just totally discretionary. You can give that whatever you see fit. And then there are these causes that we've defined as real siyuvim, or the ani erfa, who are actually needy. He says that may actually enter into the category of mamon sheyesh lo tovim, money that has a recipient who can come and demand it, who can say, you owe me this because I'm in this category. That would mean you really have to rigidly define how these rules are applied, and that's a little tricky and practical speaking. The disciple does at least consider that category. There's also a discussion whether there's a category, there's a concept known as makari kahuna. What that means is, and it looks like in the Gemara like it should be pronounced makire kahuna, but Shastra always taught us it should be pronounced makari kahuna. He has his reasons for this. But the idea of makari kahuna basically means that let's say you have a kohen. So you have somebody who takes his truma, and he's supposed to give his truma to a kohen. Now, strictly speaking, he can give his truma to any kohen. That's called tovas hanah. Expression means a person has the right, even when he has money which he can't hold on to, which is supposed to be given to a certain type cause, but he has the right to decide which person was in that cause. So that's there's some monetary value to that control. The tovas hanah, the ability to decide how to give it out, is valuable. So normally a person has to give truma, so this truma he can't eat. It's not something he owns in that sense of the word. But the fact that he has tovas hanah to decide, I'll give it to this coin or that coin, that's something that we acknowledge. However, the Gemara says that there are circumstances where a person may have his truma committed to somebody, that if he always gives his truma to the same coin all the time. So then the Gemara calls that Makari Kahuna, that this is a person who is known to have a friend who's a Kohen, and it's a Truma, so to speak, is basically his property, basically the property of this one Kohen. It's my focus, Rashi and Tosis, why that is. It could be because normally your Kohen is basically a gift to the whole, your Truma is basically a gift to the whole family of the descendants of Aaron, and that would normally be the case, but if they all know that this one coin always gets it, they all opted out. They all gave up on it, they were all Mashiach Das, and they were all left with this one coin. That's how one view on Yishonim understands it. And others have a different explanation. But the Gemara says in above Metziah, there's a concept called a Matana Mu'etes and a Matana Merubah, that if you decide you're going to give somebody a big gift, so then they know that it's such a big gift, you may change your mind, so then you need a formal process in order to make it binding. But if you have a matan mu'etes, so you say you're going to give somebody a small gift, so they think there's no reason for you to back out because it's such a small gift, so then it becomes binding because they rely on it. So it could be that's how makari kahuna works, that based on this idea that they know they always get it, and it's not a big deal for you to give it, so then it becomes binding. So the question is, do you have such a concept, let's say, of makari aniyim, if you have poor people who you always give to consistently? So does that create an obligation? Does that mean that next month you have to keep doing it like you've done every month because they've come to rely on it, and whatever mechanism that operates for makari kahuna, maybe it operates for this idea of makari aniyim also. So that's a little bit of a discussion in Poskim. Rav Sternbach has a tshuva about this, and he's worried that at least he didn't matan mu'etes, that maybe once the person is expecting it and it's in a regular pattern, that maybe there is a certain type of commitment that might be a little tricky to undo without some type of formal process. Those are some of the factors that go into figuring out who you give to and how you give to. And again, there's a lot that's variable in there. And then as far as what causes, as far as Talmud Torah, Shulchan Aruch says that there's no greater cause than to marry off basulos anios. You have these poor maiden girls, that's apparently the biggest cause to marry them off. What exactly that means is a little bit of a discussion also. She has this concept of hachnasas kala. You want to give the girl enough to, first of all, to live on. You know that that's an important factor. That if you have a couple that can't get married, if they don't have enough money to get married, so then whatever is necessary to make the marriage happen is a high priority. And then beyond that, there's also the aspect that the wedding should be bechavad, if the wedding should be something that they feel is appropriate to their dignity, which is probably related to day machzor, that in general is something, if a person is at a standard different than everybody around them, so that's a big emotional toll, and we know that that's something we take very seriously, so that's also something that comes heavily into the equation. And then on top of that, Talmud Torah is also a big priority, as we've seen. A little bit of a Shiloh or Moshe Feinstein, as the children and others have, two very different types of Talmud Torah. You have the Talmud Torah of children, called Tinoka Shel Beis Rabban, which on the one hand, as far as the continuity of the Jewish people and as far as the firm type of Jewish people, you would think that that might be the highest priority, that the little children should have a Torah education. On the other hand, you have the guys in Kolo who are really obligated in Talmud Torah and who are accomplishing at a higher level. Maybe that should be a higher priority. And also, if your society needs to have poskim, it needs to have rabbanim, it's not going to have that unless people are supported of learning at a very high level. So what exactly is the higher priority? Do you worry about the children, or do you worry about the guys in kol? That they're different attitudes among poskim. Rav Moshe has a tshuva about that, where he suggests it depends, is society basically taken care of as far as poskim and rabbanim or not? That's factored into the equation. So all of that is also part of the issue. And then the Shulchan Aruch also puts a big emphasis on Binyan Beis HaKnesses. And again, there's different gersos on what exactly that means. And it's hard to believe that really takes priority over Aniyim. So you have to figure out exactly how you factor it in. That's a complicated equation. Hi.
People might give money to state, larger state, establish a foundation for a
specific purpose. The halachic issue as to how that money should be established. The fund may set up, give it to a JNF or a federation, give it to a foundation, give it to a union only, or to...
Well, what did the person give it? If a person has
a right to favor a cause and decide he's going to set up money for a certain cause, so if the money...
It's a Yerusha. It's a foundation.
So the person who's in control, whoever it is, it wants the Yerusha, so it really belongs to the person who was Yerusha. Now, if the person gave it before he died, so you say call it Yerusha is a little bit of a confusing term. Because either it's Yerusha, in which case it's basically the money of the heir.
But somebody wants to pass away, set up an estate.
He wants to set up a fund.
A fund.
Right, so either he decided how he wants to do it.
So when he makes that decision, that's unlucky. Considerations of what kind of
so it's,
set up.
Right, so basically it's similar to everything we've been discussing till now, but the same types of factors that apply to the basic stuff you give every day apply also to how you make these decisions, but again you have a certain amount of discretion also. There are some who suggest also, this is a controversial issue, there was a whole back and forth about this in Tradition magazine a couple of years ago, I won't get into it too much, but there's a question of how much a person has a right to give away before he dies, in consideration of the fact that he has Yorshin. If a person is essentially disinheriting his family by giving all the money away to Tzedakah, so it's a little unclear to what extent, it's a little debated to what extent he has the right to do that or not. It was a hot topic a couple of years ago. It's also an equation.
He doesn't do that.
So essentially it's the same question as when he's alive. When he's alive and he decides he wants to give a large amount of money to Ben Gurion University, so the question is that the best use of his money? You have to figure out based on all these equations, is it the highest priority? What's he going to accomplish by doing that? It doesn't essentially change because he's not going to be alive anymore to see it. It doesn't essentially change. It's only this factor that there is some discussion about whether or not it's right to disinherit your family, so to speak, and what are the limits of that, which is a whole separate discussion. That comes in. That's a variable that may affect what you're asking. But as far as once you're doing that, or once you're not doing that, once you've accounted for that, so which causes, it's essentially the same type of thing as when you're alive. Hi. I'm wondering about that in general. How does it work as far as taxes are concerned? Is that I wonder about that person. Maybe there's a discussion about services separately, what Moshe has a tshuva about and talks about chesed. And it says that that chesed is something which you should view similarly to tzedakah as far as your time you save for yourself and your time you save for others. She says the rule of maaser there is probably an appropriate rule as well. They have an idea of giving a tenth of your time towards helping others. But in general, there is when you're not talking about services as a chesed, anything like gemilas chesed. If you're talking about like a person as a plumber, so instead of donating, right. Right, so pashas, that's the type of stuff. But also, I mean, how does it factor into the meiser equation? It's a good question. You count that as money earned and then subtract that. And again, the rules of meiser are a little vague, as I mentioned in the past. It's not a concept that's really set out in Shas, because there are later poskim do talk about it, and you can find many discussions about it in some of the later svarim. In an earlier svarim, the Nodi Bihuda wrote, as we mentioned, that he finds it very uncomfortable to talk about the topic because it's not really sourced in Shas. And Poskim, again, a lot of contemporary stories to talk about it, so you can look around there, about Meister in general, so you can look around there how you factor that in. But as far as being an active stockholder, presumably if a person has a choice where he could either charge $200 an hour for something or do it for a needy person for free, so then presumably that's an active stockholder or an active chesed, to figure out exactly how it's categorized. But it's a good thing one way or another. So that, as far as you're talking about Meister is concerned, so that, I think the story is basically right, that especially since the way we calculate income tax in America is based on what you earn, and people who earn more are paying more, so that's fair to say that you never really earned that money. You know, if it was a sum that everyone had to pay $200, then you could say, okay, so you earned the money, and the $200 is an expense, just like your car and your house and your food and everything else. So then it might be different. But since the idea is that it's going to go up if you earn more, it's a percentage of the money that you earn, so then it's fair to say that you never really get that money. That money is taken off the top, so to speak, in some places actually taken off the top, but in any sense, you know, basically taken off the top, and I think that's the prevalent attitude, even though that's somewhat of a discussion as well. I'm sorry? For the purposes of charity. Well, but the IRS is the one causing you to have a net income. And they're the ones taking the money.
Yeah, but I'm saying,
taking
the money,
I'm asking you to take away your expenses. I'm taking your, as far as your expenses are concerned, as far as your investment, right? That's also true. So you see, the tuitions are also complicated because there are a couple of factors. Well, I think we're almost out of time, also, because anybody, but basically, just to touch upon it, you know, there is this takana of Shulvan Gamla that everyone should be supporting the education. As far as your responsibility towards your children, so then your children, on one hand, the Gemara seems to say the responsibility is cut off at a pretty early age. The way the post can write, because Manazaj, the societal understanding is different, as it's, you know, it's more goes to a higher age. So there are some who say that if we define this as basically being your responsibility, so we have this attitude that you can't use maaser for something that's your obligation, you have to do it anyway, the whole of the maaser should be above and beyond. But there are others who have a more flexible understanding, again, of maaser, saying the whole thing is a minig anyway. A sentence you'll see a lot of times, and we'll just probably end on this because of the Chazmaier, in a lot of discussions about maaser, since it is probably perceived as a minig, and not as an absolute thing. So a lot of Svarim often use the line that when you start the practice, you start the minute, you take it upon yourself at whatever stage in your life you're ready to start doing this, so then you kind of create the understanding of what the rules are. You know, you decide, are you going to be doing it only for Aniyim, or are you going to be doing it, and however you condition it is one discussion. But again, you have nowadays many Svarim that are written in great detail that are presuming a little bit more than that. There's some kind of hard and fast rules. But you often find this line that however you're masna, so to speak, that's going to be the policy. And since Ma'ariv is starting in 30 seconds, so we'll consider that to be the final word for now.